Welcome to End of Life University Podcast, where we share real talk about life and death. I'm your host, Dr. Karen Wyatt, and I want to thank you for joining me here again today. This is episode number 456, and in just a moment, I'll be sharing a conversation I had with Tom Wachnitz, who is a chaplain and end-of-life doula working in a senior living community. And I became familiar with Tom through a blog post he wrote on LinkedIn called Reflections on My First Year as a Spiritual Care Provider and End-of-Life Doula. I really wanted to interview him because he's really brand new in this field, and I loved reading his blog post and hearing his thoughts as someone coming in with fresh eyes who's new to this field. But I was really blown away when I heard about his idea that he is actually bringing about in the senior living community to bring death doula training to the residents of the community. And that's one of the reasons I've been excited to share this with you, because I think it's such great creativity and exactly what we need to see more of in all walks of life. So I hope you'll enjoy this conversation coming up in just a few moments. And also, I will link to Tom's blog post in the show notes for this episode, and you'll find those at eolupodcast.com. And you can always go to that website. You'll find all the archives of old interviews there, along with show notes, lots of links and resources and references. There's also a search bar near the top of the page for the podcast episodes, where you can enter a topic or a speaker's name and search, and it should pull up one of the older interviews that are available on that topic or with that particular person. So you don't have to scroll endlessly through the whole list in order to find what you're looking for. So don't forget to use the search bar. And that's at eolupodcast.com. And you can also find videos of all of my recent interviews for the last couple of years on my YouTube channel. That's also called End of Life University on YouTube if you like watching videos. So go check that out and subscribe to the YouTube channel while you're there. I have one announcement to make, which is to remind you that, I'm part of a think tank with Elizabeth Johnson, Aaron Collins, and Quinn Galloway Salazar. We've been working on the compassionate communities model and how to spread that model further here in the United States. And we've created a free course called Foundations of Compassionate Communities. It's a fairly brief online course, but it's available now. And there will be a link to the course in the show notes again for this episode. Or you can go to compassionatecommunities.us, enter that URL. There you'll find a link to the previous podcast episode that I did with Elizabeth, Aaron, and Quinn, where we talk about compassionate communities and why we created the course. Then there's also a link to the course where you can go to a registration page and sign up. Again, it's totally free. We are also offering a Q&A session about compassionate communities based on our approach that we explain during the course. And this will take place on June 5th, that's a Wednesday, at 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern. Again, totally free. It's live. You can come on during that Zoom call and ask any questions that you have about compassionate communities. So if you're interested, I suggest you take a look at the course first over the next couple of weeks, and then join us on June 5th. So I'm really happy to be able to share that information with you, and I hope that you're interested in compassionate communities and will decide to get on board and take a look at that with us. And then finally, I just want to thank all of the supporters who've been making financial contributions on my Patreon page, through PayPal, and also by buying me a coffee. I want to thank you all for your support. It means everything to me. So we'll move on now with my conversation with Tom Wachnitz. I'll be back afterwards with a few takeaways and to say goodbye. So here we go. Hello. Today, I'm so excited to welcome my special guest, Tom Wachnitz. Tom is a chaplain and end-of-life doula who works with the Walker Methodist Senior Living Community and is creating what is called their Passages program that we're going to learn about today. Tom's journey has taken him from a career in technology and operations to his current role at Walker Methodist. He is earning a Master of Divinity degree, graduating in 2025, is certified by the International End-of-Life Doula Association, and is certified as a professional coach by the International Coaching Federation. Tom's desire to serve residents and families in transition led him to work in senior living. Tom wrote a blog post for LinkedIn titled Reflections on My First Year as a Spiritual Care Provider and End-of-Life Doula, and that is what introduced me to Tom. And I've been really excited to talk to him, partly to get the perspective of someone who's newer in this field, because I interview lots of people who are pioneers, who've been doing this work for 20, 25 years. And it's so very interesting to talk to someone like Tom, who's new in the field. And I wanted to tell you the website. You can learn more about Walker Methodist at walkermethodist.org. And Tom's website is oneonemtl.org. So Tom, welcome and thanks for joining me.
Oh, goodness. It's a privilege. Yeah, I the concept of the pioneers, I will say, riding along right beside me this past year has been all the work you do. So I'm so grateful. I wouldn't even want to mention all the names, but all the podcasts, all the episodes have just, every time I listen to one, I just learn something new. I take away a little nugget to serve my residents and the community and all I'm trying to do. So I'm grateful for the End of Life podcast too.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, that's always great for me to hear that this work that I do makes a difference to someone. But I'm so curious about your journey working in technology for so many years and how you ended up here in chaplaincy and as an End of Life doula.
Yeah. Well, goodness, not to try to share my whole life story, but I think there's a couple of points in my life that got me where I am today. So I grew up in a bit of a unique lifestyle. My family is fifth generation carnival business, amusement business owners. So we were on the road a lot. There were people from all walks of life that were really my family. I would be riding in a car or a truck with a college kid who was trying to find out who he was going to be or she was going to be when they grew up. And on the other side of me was a person that had been recently released from jail for Grand Theft Auto. And those people are my brothers, right? So so I grew up with this heart, I think, in naturally connecting. Another aspect of how I got there was, my mom and uncle, when I was a little kid, 8, 9, 10 years old, would help recover the returning vets from Vietnam. So I think like daycare and those kinds of things, put your kid in daycare, didn't really exist. So I was like 8, 10 years old and I just get drug along to these places. And, you know, they were eye-opening places. And then these veterans would come and stay at our house and my mom would nurse them back to sort of getting a job and getting dressed. And so I just sort of always grew in this space of this, you know, mindset and heart of service. But then I was also the kid that would take apart my bike. I'd get a brand new bike for Christmas and I'd take it completely apart, or I'd take the stereo apart. So I had this engineering mind, and it just never really dawned on me as a young person that a career in like chaplaincy or doula or those things was like, it just never, the light bulb just never went off. So I went to school for engineering, for technology, for operations, those kinds of things, and stepped into a 25-year career of implementing technology. And at a certain point along the way, I just kind of said, you know, my heart really is in this work of spiritual care and doula work. And so I started studying, with folks like Richard Rohr. I was in the Living School for a long time. I'm grateful to so many other coaching organizations that have gotten me where I've gotten. And now, since January of 2023, it's been my full-time gig. So my passion career, right?
Yeah. Wow. It's a wonderful story. I hope you'll write a memoir someday, because I would just love to hear stories from how you grew up. It sounds amazing.
Yes. There are many, many characters that I can share about. Yeah. It was fun. It was fun. It was an interesting and eye-opening experience.
I love how the uniqueness of each of our paths, that's one thing I've discovered from interviewing so many people. We each have some unique path that brings us here. And here we are in this space where we're all caring about end-of-life issues and wanting to help people as they go through transitions at the end of life. But it's just really fun hearing the stories. So thanks for sharing that.
Thank you. Yeah.
Well, we mentioned that you work with Walker Methodist Senior Living Community, and you're creating a really unique program there called Passages. And I was hoping you'd explain that to our listeners and tell them what that involves.
Yeah. So sort of the clinical connection to it is we use some of the work out of the palliative care research. So we sort of look into that research and how the assessments and how somebody moves through palliative care and how we can connect with them. And that's sort of the underlying data of the offering that we're creating. I try to stay away from the data because it's about the human experience. It's about the journey. And so on the other side of that, what we're really trying to do is develop something that can meet our residents and their families through the entire journey of their life at Walker Methodist. So, the data is overwhelmingly individuals want to die at home, right? And so we create that home for them. They move into our residential communities as independent living, and they can move through that entire life in Walker Methodist through assisted living into what I call our care suites, which is more of a hospice palliative care environment, and then do bereavement and aftercare. So it's really that whole journey of an individual that we're trying to connect with. And so in the beginning, as somebody joins the community, we're working on a lot of things like life writing and legacy and connecting to the community, having a lot of those kinds of conversations. And as one journeys through that, so as an example, in senior living, most people find out about palliative care and hospice care, and this is kind of true for the hospital, through the result of an incident, right? It's a fall or something, and then a person may be on hospice or palliative care for 20, 30 days. It's actually quite small. So we're trying to connect in conversations to bring awareness about the benefit and the value of these services, the breath that's available to families, the respite care, the non-medical care, the spiritual care, all those kinds of things, so that those aren't really surprises. They're decisions that people can step into knowingly. You did an episode with Barbara Kearns on selecting a hospice, and I think it was just beautifully done, right? About doing your research and stepping into it and being aware of a few of these points. So we're pulling that all the way through the end of one's life. I did yesterday and the day before, I did a vigil in our community, or a service of remembrance in our community. And there were in the two communities, there were, I think, about 23 people who have passed away, died in the last 3 months. And I just did a quick count. I couldn't see all of everything from the obituaries published, but a quick count. I think there were over 250, to those 22 people, there were 250 children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchildren connected. And so to think about how interconnected we are and how relational we are is really sort of the foundation, the impetus of what we're trying to build into that program.
I just love how this education and information around all the phases of aging and the end of life is available to your community, because it makes so much sense to me that, I mean, this is the education we're all saying we should all have had all along, all through our lives. And most people don't learn any of it until they're in a moment of crisis at the very end of life. And to be able to start with people when they move into your community and offer them the information, like you said, so that it's not a surprise when they need to learn about certain things. They've already heard about it and they've already had some time to prepare.
Yeah. So one of those sort of, you know, kind of slap your head moments. When I started developing the program, the engineer mind, right? I started doing the research, found the papers, had all the data. And then the light bulb went off one day and said, none of that matters. Go talk to the residents. And so I spent 3 months just sitting down with the folks in Walker, asking them questions. And there's a bit of research. It's called the Conversation Project. I forget where it comes from. You're familiar with the Conversation Project. It says something like 92 or 93% of adults with aging parents want to talk about death, and somewhere in the range of 30 or 32% of them actually have that conversation. And then they ask the parents, and 50 or 60% of them would be relieved if they did have that conversation. And when that light bulb went off, I started talking to the residents, and they informed me. I mean, they don't hold back at all about where they're at. They know clearly, you know, that they're in their last place of life, that they're going to likely die there. And so, you know, sometimes people will say, well, what do you do as a chaplain and a doula? And I think maybe I would sum it up this way is that I really hand agency and intentionality back to that senior, to that adult, to that person that's going through there. They make the decisions. They know what they want to do. We just have to sort of open our hearts and minds and allow that to start to unfold. And it unfolds beautifully, honestly.
Yeah, that's so beautiful. And you mentioned to me before we started recording that you're bringing Inelda training into the Senior Living Center as well. So tell us about that.
Chris and a bunch of folks at Inelda have just been a blessing as I've gone through my training, and I just finished my certification. So I'm officially a certified end of life doula through Inelda. I think when I look at, and again, I'm new, so I don't have some of the context of interdisciplinary teams and the weight that some of this is. I see it, the weight that's put on the physicians, I see the weight that's put on the nurses and all the teams. And so as we started to approach this idea of end of life care or life care, my boss and I sat down and we really looked at how do we make this happen? And the easiest way that we figured is to make it happen through doula training. And so I'm working with Inelda. I'll go get trained to train our volunteers. We'll train staff. And we've even had a number of residents raise their hands, their skills of life writing or their skills of vigil creation. They're passionate about being in the community with each other. They love each other, they're neighbors, and so they want to care for each other. And so we'll bring a number of residents. And really the goal there is to, empower in mass a community that can really serve, people that can sit vigil, people that can help write letters, life letters, folks that can help people work through regret and unfinished business and guilt and all of those things. And so my hope for this is that when we come a year from now, we'll have, dozens, 25, 30 people trained for a few of our communities. We're piloting it this year, and then we have 25, 30 communities, and we'll roll that out over the next few years. Mm.
It's such a beautiful idea. And I really like the idea that where you're working, it's kind of an intentional community made up of people who are ready to start looking at these issues around the end of life. So it's the perfect place to create a model that perhaps we can utilize in the broader community. Because we're all looking at that, like, how do we awaken the broader community to end of life issues, people of all ages and all walks of life? But that's a huge daunting task. And so where you're beginning, it's a community of people who've come together because they accept the fact that, you know, I'm getting older and this is where I need to be to have the services I need. And it's really perfect. And I'm just have been so excited to learn about it and that, that you're creating this, which will hopefully be a model for others.
I think it is. I hope so. And the other thing, and maybe I'm jumping ahead or a little further down the road, but I think one of the other benefits of this kind of approach is for the families. In my experience over the last year is, I don't want to sound negative, but I don't know that families really know how to use the services of hospice and palliative care and stuff like that. I don't think they have a way to really be informed. So I see a lot of families jump in sort of doing the caregiver role or trying to, you know, make sure they're there to ensure food is there. Just a lot of sort of those things. And I'm hoping one of the things that Passages as an Offering does is it starts to free the families to trust that we've got their loved one and then open up and allow them to step back to be just a family, just the journey of that end of life, whatever healing may need to occur, whatever stories can be told, you know, all of the beautiful things that we hear about the journey of one's end of life. And hopefully through that, we'll sort of shift for the families that opportunity to just be present in a sacred space.
And I really like that idea. And you're so right about that. There's so many responsibilities for family members when they're serving as the sole caregivers for their loved ones that sometimes it's hard to remember that you're a daughter or a son or a spouse because you're just trying to do the job properly and get the medications right and, you know, trying to take care of all those things. So being in a community where everything else is cared for and you can simply be at the bedside, I think that's really wonderful.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's, I mean, out of all the things that I do, I'll just quickly is those moments one-on-one with an individual, it are, for me, they're divine, they're sacred. They're the space of where divinity shows up. So.
And you feel the sacredness in that moment when someone is drawing near to their death and to be at the bedside. And it sounds like you've done some vigils at the bedside.
Yeah. A number of, and also I think, yes. And so part of that, what Passages can offer for the families and then in the doula work is to start to create the vigils. So very few individuals that I meet with or work with over the past year even have the concept of what a vigil is. There's just, it just doesn't really even exist. So we're bringing that there. But I think where I would take that is I might even back up a little bit further from the vigil in creating the story of one's life and the guided meditation. And so many times, long before we even get to the vigil or the place of where a vigil occurs, by creating this space through what we're developing with Passages and how we're approaching it, is we're starting to create these familial stories. And I can share a couple that, you know, I've gotten permission and I sort of mash them up to honor the individuals, but in privacy. But, you know, things occur like I had one person, you know, sit down with her granddaughter and share this little mixing bowl and this wooden spoon. And, you know, you wouldn't think much about that idea of a mixing bowl and a spoon. We've got, every one of us has got dozens of them in our kitchen. But the connection that that made between that granddaughter baking those cookies and baking those breads and the stories that were told and held, for me, and what I hope Passages offers is that's a generational connection that will go on and on and on. Hopefully that bowl will last for 4 or 5 or 7 more generations, right? And make hundreds of thousands of cookies. So there's that. The other aspect of sort of getting before we get to the vigil is a lot of guided imagery. And so I'll sit with folks and we'll just start walking through various levels of guided imagery that relate to whatever aspect they're at. I have a dear person right now who, for them, Jesus is the spot. Jesus is where they're going. And so we have this guided imagery and we walk down. And if you've ever been to northern Minnesota or in the mountains from where you're from, those little creeks and the paths that go down to those still ponds. And I just love it because we walk down together. She meets Jesus at the shore. I go off to the side and sort of sit there while they skip rocks. That's what they do. They skip rocks and share stories, and she finds peace and forgiveness. And then we journey back. And so that starts as early as we can get it started so that we can come to that place of peace and sacredness in the vigil.
Yeah. So people have the capacity to get to that place of safety and relaxation, no matter what else is happening.
Yeah. And that's really my hope is that I know one day we're going to take that walk. I'm going to get emotional. We're going to take that walk and I'm going to walk back alone. You know, she won't walk with me.
Yeah.
And,
yeah. You mentioned Jesus, I imagine that the imagery works for anyone regardless of their belief system. So who they meet at the pond might be someone else. It's
like, so many times, really, you know, the families and the people that I work with, 70 years of marriage is a sort of a normal number. You know, so many times that's their partner, their loved one that they're excited to see. So yeah, it's not for me to choose who that is. It's for them. And then I just help Sherpa them along.
Yeah. Yeah. I really like that because that is something that you have to practice for a while in order to utilize it as a tool. And so by helping lead people through that exercise, you're really teaching them to be able to do that for themselves, to get to that place on their own.
Yeah. Very much so.
Yeah. I love that. Tell us a little bit. You mentioned families want to be able to talk about end-of-life issues, and their parents and older loved ones also want to, but those discussions don't happen very much. And how do you help facilitate those conversations?
Yeah. So there's a number, we know there's a number of things that occur, right? There's directives and there's sort of the legal things and all of those. And one of the approaches that I see quite often is as some of those directives get put into place, especially when you get 3, 4, 5 siblings, they're not always on the same page. Mm-hmm. And so part of that conversation is as directives start to get played and put in place, I might just, if they're open to it, gather the siblings together and we talk about what's in the directives and we try to work through the differences, work through the issues that one might have. If I have a goal, which I try not to, I try to leave it open for the people to resolve. But if I have a goal, it is to say, you know, there is a sibling here. There's a that is signing on this, who is the healthcare proxy, who is likely going to make some pretty tough decisions down the road. So how do we come together with an open heart to find a way to support them? So let's work through our disagreements. Let's work through our challenges. Let's try to do that. And so by doing that, you know, sometimes it doesn't work and you just have to mm-hmm. accept that it's not going to. But many times what I find is if people start to see, oh, okay, that person's struggling with that, or that challenge is occurring for that person. And then I kind of just step back and then they start to solve those things. So that's a space in which we can help. I think the other area, and what's been really powerful about what I do and how we're going forward with passages is certainly more so as a chaplain, I'm doing a lot of spiritual assessments, and I'm trying to understand and get a sense for what people are carrying for regrets and unfinished business. And as we get into those, I think one of the powerful things about the journey of end of life that we often maybe don't take the opportunity to have is the healing that can occur between generations. And so when a mother is saying, I wasn't the greatest mother, and a daughter is saying, gosh, I'm not, you know, there, or I'm struggling with that, I'm looking for ways in which we can find a connection, where we can find healing. And many times when you bring them together with that awareness of the mother tried her very best and the daughter is, they just find a way to start to heal. And so having that sort of that conversation about life is another thing. And then I think the kind of the final part of fostering or eliciting those conversations is it's interesting how many times the light bulb's gone off for the kids that are working with me as their parents are going through this journey. And they'll come back and say, well, my wife and I are putting our directives together, or we've already written our vision. So they're starting the conversation. And so, you know, in a way, you know, my job and my journey is being with the person who's dying, but kind of my prayer and my hope is that the adult and the children of the younger families are starting to learn how to embrace life and solve some of these regrets and some of these grudges and think in terms of what their life is together and sort of just change that dynamic or so.
That's so true. Such a powerful ripple effect that this could have. And really what I was saying about, oh, we wish we could bring this to the broader community, that this ripple effect actually is a way of doing that, because you were talking about all the offspring of the people who have died. I mean, that's a lot of people who've been affected and educated and who have a much deeper understanding and probably less fear of talking about death, because their loved ones have been part of this program. And so, you know, over time, it just spreads more and more and more.
I'll put a little twist in there, but I have a peer, a partner, her name's Erin. She's a chaplain, the Reverend, and has a background in therapy. And probably her most significant qualification is she's a mother. And so we talk a lot about birth and sort of the beginning of life and what happens, you know, how we lean into that experience. But that experience, as much joy as there is in there, is fraught with fear and challenges. You don't know. My wife and I have two children who are adopted. And I mean, we had stacks of books around attachment and attachment disorder, you know, so there's all these things that I think sometimes we mentally assign to the birth that it's all going to be joyous and it's all going to be good. And we work through that by educating ourselves and having a community. And so in childhood and adulthood, we have that companion, you know, most women have a mom, or they have an auntie, or they, you know, they find a doula and they go through that. And dads like me, we just try to keep our stuff together, right? So we go through that. But we don't really have that too well defined in the end of life. And I'm not suggesting that pain will ever go away or should ever go away, right? Pain, I think, is Rumi has a poem about the guest house where he talks about, you know, welcoming that stuff in no matter how adversarial it is, because it's a teacher. So I'm not suggesting that. But I think what I'm trying to get to in the conversation we're having about community is that ripple effect as we start to shift into what the experience of death offers for generational healing, what the experience of death offers for connecting and reconnecting with each other as humans, our condition. You know, we can approach it through this lens of it being a teacher, is my hope.
I love that idea. And I think you're so exactly right about that, to be able to see death as a teacher and utilize it in that way, and then help others to see it. It's a part of life. Everything in life is here. There's something to learn from everything. Yeah. And it takes some of the fear away when we can view death in that light.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, you know, just, you know, I feel it seems like it's a spot to fit. So my father died a year ago, and it's, you know, talk about the universe telling you you're heading into this. So as I'm stepping into this new career, my father finally comes to this place where it's time and dies. And so it's like, what a teacher, right? But, you know, I think when we're open to that journey, when we're really open to that journey of healing, we're open to really connecting in levels that are deeply profound and can hold us together generationally. So just kind of a quick story. I remember as a small child, if I was ever scared, where would I go? I jumped in bed and I was with my dad. You know, it was like, that was the safest place in the world. Thunderstorm, you know, noise, a spooky shadow. And so when he died, you know, I thought about this and I thought, wow, this is just weird. This is like, this seems weird, you know, and I kind of had this egoic, like, I shouldn't do this. This is weird, but we're in the space. And the night before he died, I just crawled into bed with him, you know, and I thought, maybe, you know, maybe if that helps him feel a little safe. And I think that's my hope for what we're trying to create is we're all going to have these conversations of challenges and regrets and uncertainties. And when those happen in the last few hours or days of one's life, they're pretty tough to watch. They're really tough to watch. And I don't think anybody benefits from it at all. And so if we can start to, you know, in community, have some of these conversations earlier so that when we get into those last few days and hours, they can be those sacred moments of just presence with the person and whatever that means. I just think that's an incredible gift.
Absolutely. And I really like that you're able to start addressing those issues with people. I think when we're younger, like, we're all carrying baggage and wounds and things that need to be healed. But when we're younger, life offers so many distractions and so many opportunities to go a different direction and not think about those things. But as you progress through life and get older, as I am now, the distractions start to go away a little bit, and there's a more compelling need to start healing some of these old issues, and to be able to have the guidance to do that, you know, in a program like Passages. I think that's really powerful, because some people just, it's difficult for them to try to create the healing on their own without some sort of guidance or something leading them and telling them where to go and how to do it.
Yeah. And that was really, you know, I think that was really where some of the coaching tools come into play. I think they do that in the doula work, but in the, I very specifically took training from coaches who are more in the sort of the Ayurvedic or ontological training spaces so that we could sit with people and allow them to get a sense of where those feelings and where those challenges are coming up and then start to figure out how to get those expressed verbally, you know, which takes time for an individual.
Yeah. And so that all of the family members can benefit from that healing over time. Yeah. And that's the thing that we've mentioned here several times is that having more time is so valuable in terms of even thinking through advanced directives, having difficult conversations, healing together. And the truth is that most people don't have that much time. They come onto hospice, as you said, 1 or 2 weeks before they die. And that might be the first time they've ever addressed any of these issues.
Yeah.
And it's not nearly enough time to do the work that needs to be done.
Yeah. I think that's what, I think that's a part of in my first few months. And I had been hospice volunteer and worked in cancer centers as, you know, a patient escort and volunteer. So I had seen some of it very anecdotally, but I hadn't seen it really to the degree that I did when I started as a chaplain. And I don't mean to make light of it, but that's it exactly. Somebody will get introduced to hospice. I'll sit down with them. We'll talk a little bit about spiritual care. And then they'll blurt out, well, I haven't talked to my son for 27 years. And in the back of my head, I'm like, wow, it's unlikely that we're going to remediate those 27 years of issues in the statistically speaking 30 or so days that we have. And that's where those light bulbs started to go off. And I looked back into that palliative care work and that research out of those environments and said, how do we start to have these conversations earlier? And they're tough. I get it. I want to be sensitive to that. But I think if we don't, for me, at least, if I don't, I feel like I'm doing an injustice or I'm leaving somebody in a space where I might otherwise provide some value in the job I've chosen.
And I'm curious to know, in the Passages program, do you meet much resistance from some people? Are there ever people who just don't want any part of it? Or just how are people accepting it? The whole program.
Yeah. A couple ways to tackle that question. I think as a whole, maybe the concept of the interdisciplinary team is going to continue to mature, right? So again, I'm new to this. I hear and see, you know, all these ideas of like physicians should be trained more, physicians should do this, physicians should do that. And I, in my brain, I'm like, man, that's lumping a lot more responsibility onto a profession who's already pretty taxed when you look at how that's unfolding for physicians. So it doesn't mean that I don't think they should be educated, but part of what we're trying to do is have stand-ups and have care plans that we can start to talk more interdisciplinary about. And I think as people have started to see that, they start to let go a little bit, like, oh, we have people here that can help us. So as an example, in the spaces that I go and work, I sit in the nursing stations. I sit with the nurses because I ultimately want them to know me, to see me, to say, hey, we're struggling here. Can you go talk to this person? Or how can I help create a conversation earlier about palliative care? So there's that whole thing. And I think they're very receptive to that. And even the, you know, if you wanted to go as far as say financial, even the financial data in hospital and hospice systems suggests earlier knowledge of palliative care and hospice is a financial benefit to the organization. Like that data is there. So it's just, how do we do that? So that's kind of that mechanic of it. On the family side, I think the really interesting thing that occurs most when there's resistance is there's sort of this shift of parental child relationship where the children will come in and it's just like, you're doing this, this is where we're going, we're doing this. And you can just kind of see the mom or dad sitting there like, you know. And so part of maybe the resistance there is working with the families or creating a space with the families where they can start talking about the decisions that the individuals want. It goes back to sort of that agency and intentionality, right? Like, how far does this person want to go? How much hospital do they want? I have some residents who get dialysis every day because they want to keep living, and that's the space they're in, and that's what they choose. And I have some residents who have, you know, been diagnosed with dementia, and in a few weeks they decide that they're going to take an approach that's dramatically different through, you know, VSAD or MAID or, you know, or something like that. And so we have to try to find a way. I think if there's any resistance to continue to shift that knowledge and awareness that that person, we can trust that that person has a good, pretty good insight on what they want to do and how they want to do it.
Yeah. And I think you're right. We have to meet people where they are and honor whatever their choices are, where they are at their place in life. And then we don't overcome help with resistance by pushing against it. We actually help by creating a safe space and honoring people for being who they are and accepting wherever they are on their journey.
Right. Right. Yeah. And yeah. And again, it's nurturing into the care of that individual, right? It's really holding that space for the pain that exists, because it is painful. And I don't ever pretend that it's not. But as we start to have these conversations, it kind of goes to the birthing, right? The more we know, the more we started to learn, the more we start to have these conversations, that we tend to shift into this space of the natural flow of it, the natural rhythm of it, maybe is a better way to say it.
Yeah, I really like that. I wanted to say, I'm just so impressed that Walker Methodist is so open to having a program like Passages. And I don't really know if there are any other senior living communities out there, or if you know that either, who are considering this idea or open to it. But it's what we need. It's the thing we need. And I'm hoping like by having this conversation, we might inspire people to think about it. What could they add to the intentional community they're creating that would help people be more cognizant of end of life?
Yeah. I haven't bumped into many either. So that's true. My hope is, and as I've listened to a few of your podcasts, I'm looking to make some connections, because I think, I forget the name. What's the hospice house model that you've shared a few times?
Oh, the Omega Home Network.
Omega Homes. I think that's just a wonderful vision for how we can maybe start to create business plans and models and share, you know, with each other some of these ideas. So there's some of that kind of percolating in the back of my head. I think as we start to think about the doula work, like, for example, I would love to even see, you know, I hadn't really thought about it, but I'd even love to see as an individual moves into our independent living, maybe some of the children want to be trained as doulas. So, you know, because I'd love to just give that gift right back to the family. I mean, imagine how powerful that is when it's just, you know, right there in the family.
Yeah, that's such a great idea. And to be able to get the training right there at the place within the community where their loved one is living.
Yeah. Yeah, and I I think the doula already exists within everybody. Maybe it's we have to unlearn the conditioning we have so that that doula can exist. And for me, I just grew up in a home where death was very much natural. It was always at home. I think there's only a few instances where, you know, I had an aunt who had a kidney transplant and some others that were died of accidents, who died in hospitals, but everybody did it at home. It was like a net, you know, I re little kid and there's grandma lying over on a table while they're doing the funeral in the living room. And it's like, okay, that's how it is. So to maybe think of it in terms of not so much learning, but just sort of unlearning the conditioning that we have about, you know, putting death at a distance.
I think that's a really good point because if you think about it, I mean, caring, dying has been part of the human experience since the very beginning. And so it's almost a primal instinct for us to know how do we care for one another when we're dying, because it's part of every single life that has ever existed. I think you're right. If we unlearn the things that have taught us to avoid death and fear death, that we will find within ourselves that natural instinct.
Yeah, and that's where Erin, as I mentioned earlier, she and I spent, that's why we talk so much. I mean, when you look at like birth, right? Somebody in your family has a baby. Nobody really needs to tell you how to hold the baby or feed the baby or, you know, don't shake the baby or all, you know, that's all. We just know that stuff. And we've kind of unlearned, you know, can I hold that person's hand? I don't have to talk. I can sit in silence. This is going to be okay. Well, let them be the way they want to be. So we spend a lot of time sort of bantering back and forth those ideas about how they may or may not inform one another, what distinctions may need to be thought about.
And you've talked a bit about sacred presence and being able to be present with someone at the end of life. And then in your blog, you wrote about using the intentional pause when someone dies. So I wondered if you'd talk a little more about that.
Absolutely. Again, not to throw shade into some of these great systems, the hospice and healthcare and palliative care work, funeral homes, all of those. But I think they kind of condition us to just jump to the next thing, right? And I see that quite often. Somebody will die, and sort of the immediate response is, well, okay, we'll call the funeral home, right? And so this intentional pause, or this idea of the intentional pause, and we've done this with passages, and I'm sure this is probably very common, I would imagine, in others, but we do a service called the Dignity Quilt. And so our very intentional pause is that when a person dies, we connect to the family, the primary caregivers of the family, and we just ask, where are we at? And some will say, I'm not interested, everything's okay, call the funeral home. And some will be, well, yes, let's wait. And so person may die at 2 or 3 in the morning or 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and we'll wait until the afternoon when the family can be present. Or we'll wait until the morning, and then at that point we'll do just sort of a pause, a end of life ritual. Now, if we've set something up in a vigil, we'll follow that, those rituals, cleansing the body, whatever culturally they may want to do as well. The point, I think, in the whole thing of the intentional pause is just to again sort of educate families, right, to unlearn the conditioning that they've been shared is that there's no hurry. There's really no hurry. You know, you can ask the nurses and the RAs to clean up the room, to make the bed, to maybe pull the ventilators or the air and oxygen off, comb their hair, make their bed, and sit there and pause. most states, I think Minnesota for sure, I know Minnesota, I believe, is a body can lay and rest until its burial. So 2-3 days. I might not advocate for that. There are some Eastern religions who need that, honor that. So we support that. But I think within a, you know, 3-4 hours, 8 hours to sort of bring yourself into that place and have that space and that time for stillness and pause and grieving is something that I just don't think many families are aware of. They just sort of don't know that it's available to them.
Yeah, so true. I think back to when my mother died, and she died with hospice care at home, and I was her caregiver. But the hospice nurse, as a way of trying to help me and lessen my burden, called the funeral home immediately, and they showed up right away. And I, at the time, I didn't have the presence of mind to realize, like, no, I need more time. And I kind of needed someone to help me protect that space. Yeah. But the nurse didn't think, she thought she was doing me a favor. Let's just get this, let's just get her out of here as fast as we can. But honestly, it was so devastating when they took my mom away, and I felt like, oh my gosh, I missed my chance. I just needed to sit with her. I just wanted to be in the room with her. So I realized, even me as someone who was knowledgeable about these things, I couldn't advocate for myself very well in that moment right after she died. I needed someone else there who was informed, who might say, would you just like to be here with your mom a little longer? Why don't we wait and call the funeral home later?
I think it's a great point. I think it's a point that only reinforces what we've been talking about with the strength of the community, right? Is to be alongside, to know and to respect, hey, you know, maybe Karen isn't in that space, let me step in and be an advocate. Let me step in and hold that space to double check. And also to have just that real conversation to check in. How are you doing? Oh, I think I need a little more space. Okay. And create that space. So I think your point is perfect. Yeah.
Well, I want to say, Tom, as someone who's new to this end of life field, like, you bring such a beautiful, pure perspective to all of these issues. Some of us who've been around a while might be cynical in a way, or have negativity about changes we've seen. And I just love talking to you because your intention is so pure, and you see what's possible, and you see what can be created given the way things are right now. It's very refreshing to talk to you about that.
Yeah, thank you. And I would add, sometimes I might get a little out there and too far, but one of the things that we're doing within the context of continuing to develop passages, and what I hold is whatever we're creating has to be sustainable, right? We have to move toward it being sustainable within the organization. And so many times the data tells us that these things are, you know, when you look at like hospital systems and knowledge of palliative care, how much that saves, when you look at all of these different little data points. So I very intentionally don't talk about the sustainability, because I don't want to be leading with, hey, this is a business problem, let's solve it. I think this is a human opportunity to create community and connect deeper at a heart level. But we are also very much focused on how do we provide this in a way that is sustainable as well.
Then that's a huge factor that I think back in my old early days in hospice, that discussion about sustainability was missing. And that was an error that we're still living with now and still trying to figure out.
Well, I think a lot of, I don't know, maybe after they watch this, they'll say no, but I think a lot of my leaders at Walker sometimes scratch their head because I am a chaplain and a doula and all of those things, but I also came out of 25 years of running a business for corporate world and had large P&L. So I'm kind of, my wheels are always turning in you know, in that space. And I think that if we lead with our heart and we do a check-in on sustainability, we're going to come up with some really great. I hear so many, like your podcast. I mean, I like literally every time I hear a podcast, you know, the Omega Homes and some of the things, the other things, and so many of the videos that I see, the DT conversation that you had in the video and what's happening there. And I just like, they're all finding a way to do this work.
Yeah. The wheels are turning everywhere, yeah, and things are in process everywhere. We have to stay optimistic because of that.
Absolutely.
Well, Tom, I know that you do coaching through your website, 1MTL.org.
Yeah.
Are you open if anybody reached out, even a doula or someone else who's interested in this kind of work? Would you do any coaching with someone in that situation?
Yep. Yes, often helping folks do that. So yeah, I do coaching. I think many times people are looking for something to grab onto. What does my business look like? Should I start a website? And so many times I have to sort of, we backtrack a little bit and just be like, well, what do you feel? Are you a great writer? Are you? And so we explore that. And so often I'm always available to coach. Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
thank you for asking.
That's really wonderful. Well, I'm so impressed with everything that you're doing, and I'm so excited that I got to meet you. And I will leave a link in the show notes to your blog post, Reflections on My First Year as a Spiritual Care Provider and End-of-Life Doula, the Walker Methodist website, and your website. And I look forward to hearing where you go with this, with the Passages program.
Yeah, I'd love to come back and share. I'm excited. We're just really, we've done a lot. I've done a lot of the sort of frameworking of it and figuring it out. And we're just starting into piloting and committees and things like that. And so I'm really excited. So hopefully in the fall, I'll have something really nice to share.
Yeah. We'll make a plan to do a follow-up.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, thanks again, Tom, and take care.
Yeah. Be well. Thank you for your time.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed that conversation I had with Tom Wachnitz and feel inspired as I did about this idea of bringing death doula training to senior living communities and even senior centers or assisted living facilities, other types of areas where seniors live, offering seniors and their family members doula training as just a fantastic way of spreading more information about death doulas, helping more people become death aware and prepared for end of life situations that they may find themselves in. And I just think this is a fantastic way to reach out to the members of our community who are more likely to be open and ready to hearing about death doulas and death doula training. So anyway, get in touch with Tom if you're interested in working with him or learning more about what he's offering. And if you like this content, please be sure to share it with other people who might also be interested in these conversations that I have. And you can go to my webpage, eoluniversity.com/support. If you'd like to find three different ways that you can make a small financial contribution and help keep this show on the air, and I really appreciate it. So I'll be back next week, and I'll be sharing with you a conversation I have with my friend Christina Holbrook, who wrote the novel All the Flowers of the Mountain that we published after her diagnosis of a glioblastoma, and also with Walker Vreeland, who's a producer who just finished producing Chris's audiobook for All the Flowers of the Mountain, and who also has his own journey through serious illness. And we talk a lot about creativity when faced with a serious life-threatening illness. And I think you'll really enjoy that. So tune in next week to hear that conversation. And until then, remember, we're here for love. So face your fear, be ready for whatever life brings you next, and love each and every moment of your very precious life. Bye-bye.